ultimately are trying to catalyze a community so they can lift themselves up. I often worry that it becomes too much about the helper and not enough about empowering the people. We want to think about how do we do this job well enough so they won't need us. If we're not there to work ourselves out of a job, we're actually not doing our job correctly.
Hey everyone, it's Hildy, and this is the Creating the Future podcast. I'm glad you've joined us here today. This is a place for us to explore what really creates social change. What will actually create the healthy, joyful future we all want to live in? I am so happy that Seth Kaplan is joining us on the podcast today. Seth is the author of the book, Fragile Neighborhoods, Repairing American Society One Zip Code at a Time. Seth is a lecturer at Johns Hopkins University, a senior advisor to the Institute of Integrated Transitions, and a visiting fellow with the Mercatus Center's program on pluralism and civil exchange. Seth's work has seen him creating strategy and implementing programs for governments and organizations around the world, including the World Bank, USAID, and the U.S. State Department. Given his focus on repairing and building strong neighborhoods, talking to Seth inspires us to find those places right outside our own front doors where we can begin to make a big difference right now. And so it is my joy to welcome Seth Kaplan to the podcast today. Welcome, Seth, to the podcast. It is such a pleasure to have you with us today.
It's a great pleasure to be with you today, Hildy.
So if you could just tell our listeners a little bit about what is it that in your life that got you into social change sorts of work? What was it about your life that led you into this path?
Well, I would say there's a few chapters in my life. I would say I work on fragile neighborhoods in the United States, but I also work on fragile states. And before that, I did business. So I think the real question is, why did I stop doing business and when did I focus more on society? And I would say that went back to, I don't know, my late 20s, 30 years old, early 30s. Around then, I did have a company. I did live overseas. I had already wandered to lots of places and ended up in China. Those were the glory days for China. It's not quite the same today. And I was running this business and it just increasingly occurred to me that my destiny, so to speak, or my passion was about bigger questions about how societies work or don't work, what will make countries have better results for their people, and so on and so forth. And so I think it was several things. One, it was the people. I just couldn't care enough about money compared to my peers. They're always going to do something extra. And I was more interested in the learning or the journey than I was in the money. So one was I wasn't very materialistic. One was I had this deeper desire to understand and then find a way to have an impact on these bigger social questions. And so literally, this wasn't like I woke up one day. It was a gradual evolution over many years. And at some point, I came back to the United States and I had a period of time where I didn't know what I was doing. And for those of us who like to move around and like to feel like every day we're doing something, to have no plan, that is challenging. So I find it really healthy whenever I have someone I just spoke to recently in between jobs trying to figure it out. There's a healthy, as long as you don't have to worry about money, at least in the short term, there's something healthy about a rethink or a reset. So I had like a reset and a period of time, and eventually I was doing some consulting, but I was still thinking through this. Eventually, I started writing. Then I started going to events. Then I started getting involved in a lot of projects. Then I co-managed a nonprofit. Now I got my fourth book out. And so the whole thing was there was something inside of me. There was something about my interaction with people. And then the gravity or the energy took me bit by bit onto a completely different path journey. And that's how I got into social change.
It's wonderful. It's just an evolution.
It's an evolution, yes. I would say, I know there's people that wake up and they get hard breaks, but I'm not a hard break kind of person. I'm like, let's feel it out. Let's be organic. Let's find our way through. Let's make sure it's the right process. And even when I moved to where I am now, like physically moved, we wanted to test it out before we were going to buy a house. So it's like everything you do, there's like a test, there's a feeling. I'm really into organic, and relationships are a part of that. And it's not like you meet someone all of a sudden, the world has changed. Everything is organic. So I definitely believe in that pathway.
That emergent journey, I love it.
Emergent. Emergent's a great word.
I love it. Well, in your experience and in your work has been varied since then as well. What do you find when you see change happening? What do you find is undergirding that change? What creates change?
Again, if you're just thinking change, good or bad, there's a lot of factors.
Let's focus towards the good.
Well, I'll just say, if you're thinking about change in a community or society, mm-hmm. again, change can happen because there's an earthquake. You know, there's a lot of like external shocks or things that happen like that. But I would say it could be a leader. It could be relationships. I would say people have to have a sense that this place or this group is important. So there's a certain allegiance, and I would say social dynamic that underpins it. I would say there's a certain agency, specifically leaders. I'm a big believer that for change to happen and be sustained, institutions are hugely important. I'm not a big fan of the heroic person's going to show up and save us all. Again, there are certainly times and things I've seen where there's one person. I can think of specific countries like Ghana or South Africa or what have you, where one person really made a huge difference. But over time, what you see for change to work and be self-sustaining, you really need good institutions. That's always more than a person. And so I would say it's a combination of, again, sense of place, this place matters, sense of the individuals and agency, the institutions, the dynamic between many actors. When people are at each other's throat, or they're competitive, or they don't care so much about each other, of course, that can work against change. I would say there's other things. If a place is more beautiful, maybe people care more about it. It can be something as simple as that. And there are studies that say that beauty is one of the most important reasons why people double down on a place versus wow. abandoning the place. So there's a lot of factors, but there's a handful to start us off with.
Talk a little bit about institutions. What kinds of institutions? What kinds of institutions are necessary for sustained, especially sustained social change?
I'm working especially now on neighborhood level, community level. So we're talking relatively small scale. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I would say the types of institutions we need at a small scale, of course, is very different than we need at a large scale. The United States is 330 million people. I could be working in 5,000 or 10,000 person level. So again, there's great variation, sure. but in general, we want an abundance and a variety of institutions. So if I'm thinking local, there's family institutions, there's civic institutions, there's social institutions, there's religious institutions, there's government institutions, there's economic institutions. All of these matter. If a place has a lot of them, they're more likely to do well. I also know places that are not doing well. And one of the biggest drivers of change is you put in an anchor institution or a quarterback institution, and it helps organize. In fact, I was even within the last week at a conference, and one of the main themes is neighborhood quarterbacks in fragile or neighborhoods that aren't doing very well. That's more high poverty neighborhoods, because of course you could be wealthy and also be fragile because people don't know each other. But in poor neighborhoods where there's generally a lack of institutions, sometimes you have to embed an institution. But in general, all the items I said, if a neighborhood has lots of these different types of institutions, it's highly likely to thrive and have many, many people standing up, many people caring, many people stewarding the place, standing up when something needs to be done, collaborating. Those things are all very important.
What is a quarterback institution?
So quarterback is, if you go to a neighborhood that has very few local institutions, there's maybe the primary school, high school's probably not nearby. You might have some government or nonprofit. You might have a couple of churches and there's not a lot else. It's a bit of a, what I would call an institutional desert. Mm-hmm. So there's no institutions with enough capacity, enough resources, enough of a social network to make a huge difference. In that case, the neighborhood's high poverty and mostly people, it's a high churn. People are like, could be 25% churn, which is typical of the worst neighborhoods. And it's simply not doing very well.
And by churn, you mean that people are leaving?
People are leaving, yes. A good neighborhood, maybe one out of every 20 leave every year. A neighborhood doing badly, one out of every 4 leaves.
Wow, wow.
Just think, and if you're in a school in that neighborhood, it could be half the kids turn over within a year.
Wow.
So really hard to make the school better, really hard to make the neighborhood better because you make a little progress and then you start over again.
Yeah.
So a neighborhood quarterback is like an institution that's embedded into the institution. I mean, the particular case we're talking about is institution that's set up with some management, or like in a board, strong network in the city or the region, and it's working on making the schools better. It's working on making the housing better. It's working on helping catalyze lots of small businesses, making the streets better. It's basically making that neighborhood an attractive place for people to want to leave and other people to want to move in and set up institutions. And so in essence, it's a major change agent. Some places, the vicious cycle prevents any individual at a smaller scale from making change. A quarterback comes in and says, we're going to do 4 or 5 things at the same time. And that will catalyze. It will be like a trigger that once it shows that some change is happening, a lot more organizations or people will come in. And that, and a vicious cycle can turn into a virtuous cycle, and the neighborhood gets on a more positive trajectory, and then you begin to have that abundance of institutions. I bet if you walk around, you're in Tucson, I don't know Tucson very well, or Phoenix very well, but if you walk around in a Chicago or a Baltimore, these cities, they're a little bit more contained. So you see it, you go to one neighborhood, it's doing really well, and there's a lot of stuff going on. You go to another neighborhood, it's basically housing doesn't look good, streets don't look good, no one feels very safe, no one's starting a business, there's not many civic institutions. How do you go from one to the other? It's not easy. A lot of efforts try and fail, but a quarterback is there for 10 years or longer, it sustains the effort and it has the capacity. I mean, even if you don't have that, there's ways to do that, but it's got to be piecemeal with the same idea that we're doing lots of things at once, because one thing like just housing or something is not going to fix a neighborhood.
Now, is that coming from outside the neighborhood or is that boiling up from within?
It could be both. It could definitely be both. So the neighborhood quarterbacks, I'm thinking Atlanta right now, where they're working in 6 neighborhoods. They have a citywide strategy and they're specifically, I'm not quite sure I would say appointing, but by mutual agreement, there's nonprofits that are going to service quarterbacks or some, there might be a foundation, might be someone already working in one neighborhood, go to another neighborhood. So they're going to have 6 quarterbacks for 6 neighborhoods and they're going to work and there's going to be other institutions involved. But the whole idea is a more strategic approach to ensuring these 6 neighborhoods over the next 10 years are transformed. In those cases, it's more externally driven, but you also can have someone inside, it could be a university who's next to a neighborhood, it decides it's going to be, it could be like an anchor quarterback. These are a little bit different meaning, but anyway, they steward the neighborhood. It could be that there's a couple of small organizations come together and they do something like this. Generally, the challenge is if you're on the inside, you lack the capacity and the network, and yet you want to be on the inside because you know the people, you know the place, you know the challenges. And you represent the people more than the organization. From the outside, it just may be you lack the capacity, some of the broader networks, to do what's needed to be done.
I'm thinking of my own neighborhood, and I'm thinking about the ebb and flow of people getting involved. We have an institution, we have a neighborhood association. I'm just thinking about how it comes back to the leadership and the people part of what you were talking about earlier, that when there's leadership that's actively involved, the neighborhood is alive and vibrant. And when nobody wants to step into that position, we are all real good with each other, but we're not moving forward on any projects. I'm really sensing the people part of what you started with earlier.
Everything is the people. We don't work on a country. We don't work on a neighborhood, whatever it is that I do, fragile states, fragile societies, fragile communities, if we're not there to help the people.
Yeah.
The people are the key. If we're not putting them front and center, we're not doing our job right. Of course, sometimes we need external resources, external institutions, but ultimately front and center must be the people, and we must think how we can help the people help themselves. That's the most important thing we're trying to do. Too many efforts to help don't put the people front and center, and they don't enable the people to help themselves. That, to me, is the most important thing. I think there's even a book from 30 years ago, don't ask me the title, but I remember it, something about helping people help themselves or whatever it was, something like that. The whole idea is we don't just give something humanitarian, because it's like the old story about fishing. If you just give a person a fish, they're going to need the fish tomorrow. But if you can teach them to fish, they're not going to need you anymore. So in my view, when you're trying to help and you're trying to make change, ultimately are trying to get people or help people catalyze a community, a place, or people so they can lift themselves up.
It's the difference between the charity model and the justice model.
Yes. I don't think of it in those terms, but what I would think about, is it developmental or is it humanitarian? There is a role for humanitarian, but the humanitarian is there when there's a crisis or when there's an immediate need. If there's not developmental part of it, you're just waiting for the next crisis is what you're doing.
We frequently talk about it at Creating the Future as seeing intervention as the goal. So often conflate intervention with the real goal, which is to create the community that we do want to live in. And what we so often wind up doing is intervening on what we don't want and seeing, okay, well, if that's better, then we've done our job. And better than bad is still not good. But it's that intervention model.
I would say I do see the great need for foreign aid, for example, or I do see the great need for social services. I often worry that it becomes too much about the helper and too much about the help and not enough about empowering the people. And in general, at least everywhere I see, it's relatively easy to solve an immediate problem like vaccines. One of the greatest achievements in foreign aid in the last 50 years is simply the improvement of basic health involving vaccinations and lots of other things for people all over the world. On the other hand, one of the biggest failures is we haven't helped countries that are more fragile improve their capacity to develop. Some countries have done well, but too many countries have been left behind. And I don't think the way we help them really enable them to lift themselves up. So I would just say, we want to think about not about ourselves. We want to think about how do we do this job well enough so they won't need us, which is really hard to get through our heads, but it's so essential. If we're not there to work ourselves out of a job, we're actually not doing our job correctly, in my opinion.
So what have you seen in terms of maybe a story of where you've seen people working themselves out of a job and seen the results of that?
Well, you want domestic or you want international?
Pick one.
Pick one. I think in the U.S., we have hundreds, if not thousands, of neighborhoods that are not doing well. We have a few hundred thousand neighborhoods, roughly. And I think you can go to some neighborhoods that everyone has a nice house, but nobody knows each other. There's no way to congregate. Everyone is more vulnerable, more at risk, more lonely. And the place is not very resilient. And if there's a chance to move to a better place, you'll leave. And that place will just go downhill. And we see that about a lot of neighborhoods. I think you can certainly find, like I see in some cases in Atlanta, of where there was a sustained effort over many, many years. I can think of an example in Dallas, which is at least on my map, not so far from Arizona. It's only two states over. But again, it is probably, whatever, 700, 800, 1,000 miles away.
They're big states.
It looks like big states, but I was there last year. I know a person who literally moved into the poorest neighborhood in the city and spent many, many years there. And he eventually started one of the country's largest urban farms. And basically, through his work, he helped people bond, and now he's moved on since then, since the farm. The farm now has a coffee shop. The farm now has a market. The farm hired people. The farm has helped improve schooling. They started some pre-K in there. They're working on primary. They've just set up a health center there. They've brought in some sort of finance, like a community bank, but more like financial remediation to basically help people who are not used to dealing with financial institutions undo whatever debt they have or whatever liens they have, and then gradually give them the capacity to save and buy assets. Mostly, a lot of our institutions don't work well for poor people because there's not a lot of money to be made with the poor people. So here he set up in the neighborhood all the types of institutions, or he's working towards it, that did not exist. So this place, if you look over the years, poverty is down, income is up, property prices are up, crime is down. And so I can find examples, and people start wanting to live in the neighborhood, which is it's not in a great place, but it's only a short distance from downtown Dallas. And previously, the prices maybe were 1/10 of a neighborhood a similar distance away. So even if you get to 1/2, it's still pretty attractive. And so you can find examples of people and institutions. I mean, he's done this through his institutions, but he himself literally gave up a corporate job and just showed up and moved into the neighborhood. It took him a long time to get the trust, and that's a big part of it. But the whole point is there are plenty of examples, if you do the work right, that we can make places better.
I'm struck by the long-term commitment to it and how that goes counter to so many funding cycles that are, we'll fund you for 2 years or we'll fund you for 3 years. But what you're talking about is really the fact that change takes time, and that long-term commitment, this person lived there for 10 years, that long-term commitment of what it takes. You can't build trust in the time of a one-year grant. So I'm really struck by that need for that long-term.
I would say it's not only the long-term, it's also the fact that the metrics are not capturing what he's doing. Mm. And we have an obsession with metrics. It also means that this obsession with scaling, he's not scaling. He's only focused on a particular place. So I would generally say is there's a need to hold the people you give money to accountable. The question is whether we have the right time frames, the right metrics to make the real change that's necessary work. In my opinion, we have to rethink funding mechanisms, funding models, even most funding models, because they want measurable results in a reasonable or a short period of time, they end up doing the silo. They do a silo on housing, they do a silo on this, a silo on this. And all those silos basically means the place never gets better. And the few people that really benefit, they leave and the place gets worse. So in essence, you could be achieving your goals and more people are being left behind. Mm. And I think that's one of the major problems of the way we try to help people today. If we don't uplift places, when you uplift the place, you uplift everyone in the place. When you just focus on this, I would call it humanitarian, but when you just focus on addressing specific social ills one by one by one, you address them today, you may not help that person tomorrow. Or if you do, they likely move on and all the people around them get worse. So the model doesn't work for me. And that's why we need a different model with different measurements and a different frame of reference of what success looks like.
You know, it's reminding me, creating the future is so obviously future focused. It's in our name. What we look at is what will good look like in the community when you're done, in the neighborhood, in the place. And I'm really appreciating that word place, because when you look at those individual problems, you're reacting rather than creating. What you're talking about really is creating place, a sense of place, the institutions in the place, how people relate to the place, rather than here's an individual problem, here's another problem, here's another problem, which is what those business style metrics, they really are business style metrics. They want numbers. How many people are how much better in this very narrow area? But what you're really talking about is everything that's interrelated for what we want to create in community.
I would say many of the business efficiency ways of thinking have invaded and taken over the nonprofit world. And there's some very good things that came out of that, because I know from my experience in the two worlds that businesses generally are better run. I have to be very honest. Businesses are better run. They have clear goals. If you're a nonprofit or if you're in philanthropy, your goals are not always clear. Business has clear goals. Businesses tend to have clear accountability. If something doesn't work, you know about it pretty quickly. And so in general, that makes sense that some of these ideas will translate or some of the ideas should migrate. The question then becomes, if you make your whole model that model, what are you missing that's different in the social sphere? And for me, the thing that's missing is that relationships matter, place matters. And when you only focus on individuals and unit metrics around units and metrics around individuals, you're basically atomizing. You're atomizing and you're, in essence, driving people outward. And you arguably could be making places worse, yeah, even while you're achieving your goals. And so the big question is, how do we keep some of those good things from business, but have a different frame that's more fit for how society works? And society, again, what is society? Society is relationships, and that every place is a little different society. So we are a big society composed of lots of little societies, and those little societies are to a significant extent based on specific places. Mm. And if we don't think that way in terms of social change really means relationship change. Wow. Our social problems is really problems that are downstream from a problem with relationships. That is what the term means. But how often when people talk about these things, do they ever think of the role of relationships in place? Yeah. Very rarely. That to me is a huge problem.
Well, we don't value relationships. We say we value relationships.
But we don't show it. We don't show it in our metrics and our performance and everything that we do.
Yeah, in practice, we definitely don't. One of the things that has always made me crazy is you bring a group of people together, maybe a new coalition or a new project, and we spend zero time getting to know each other under the guise that we need to, quote, honor people's time and get down to business. And everything that you're talking about that unravels when we don't build relationship, we don't build trust, and then we point at whatever thing happened, but the whole root of it is that we didn't build the relationship to start with.
I would say so. When I meet people, I very much try to slow down a bit and know something about them. It's really hard in this Zoom world. I'm thinking of two phone calls I had this morning for my work, and we had things I had to get done. And I did my best to give the first 15 minutes for some relationships. Who are you? Where do you come from? And I think some of my questions were maybe a little bit more relational than people are used to. But again, you are greatly constrained. Even if you sit next to someone at an event, I'm thinking last week in an event when I was in Houston, oh, I don't want to talk about your work. I want to know more about you. So you got an hour. I learned a little bit more about the person that had three kids. Her mother was from El Salvador. I learned all this interesting stuff, got maybe 5 minutes or so about the organization. That's okay. It's not as interesting for me.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're trained to think that way. And if you look at all the numbers on how our society is doing, I think a lot of it is simply we're on our phones, we're about ourselves, we're almost scared to know people. We're not practicing. You're going to get disconnected. Society's going to be atomized if we're just being taught that the phone is all that matters and your job is all that matters. And we're out of practice, to be very honest, on so many levels.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. I love that you use the word practiced and trained, because naturally we're wired to connect with each other. I mean, that's the only way humans survive.
That's the default. Except if you grow up or you're immersed in your phone and social media, I think a lot of youth are literally wired to pay attention to social media, Instagram, whatever it is. Their wiring is getting changed. And I very much worry about that. And I've written some things about that. I actually have something I'm going to put up tomorrow, the day after we're recording this, about how the number of youth, 12th graders, they don't date. They don't socialize. They don't have a job. How that number, the three no's, gone up like 5 or 6 times in one generation. So that's like what we see over and over again, because the alternatives are drawing them away.
Part of me wonders if the draw of social media. And, you know, obviously there's the addictive part of just the technology, but I have to wonder if the draw of social media is that draw to connect.
I think there's something there, but the technology, the tech companies are using that. I'm on my phone all the time. I'm working on my phone. You can see how the phone draws you in, something new, more information, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's quite different if you grew up in the real world and then you have the phone. But if that's how you grow up and you're not practicing the alternative, you almost forget or don't really learn in a healthy manner the alternative, the norm.
Yeah.
And we do see that with things on mental health and depression. And we literally do see young people saying that we need to stop this. The problem is if everyone's doing it, how do you stop alone?
Exactly. I'm curious, your most recent book is on fragile neighborhoods. And I'm curious if there's anything in the creation of that book that surprised you. Is there anything you learned that surprised you?
Well, when I started, my work internationally about fragile states or societies is always about the social, the relational. So when I started, people asked me 2015, 2016, what is wrong with the U.S.? Are we becoming fragile? I mean, that didn't make sense to me coming from Sri Lanka or Somalia or Nigeria. But when I started thinking about it, my first step was, what is happening with the relationships? Why do we have these problems now and we didn't have them 30 years ago or 40 years ago? What has changed? So the big question is, what has changed with our relationships? But when I started, I never thought I would go to neighborhoods. I thought it would be a bigger question because mostly I work on bigger questions. Mm-hmm. So the biggest surprise was that I ended up on the local. And it took me several years to get there. And a few people helped me understand that. Once you change your frame of reference, you see, of course, the local has been devastated. The institutions are no longer there. The relationships are no longer there. And how does that affect our psychic? How does that affect our sense of agency that we have very much less influence? How does it affect the health of lots of places? The biggest surprise was that. I think the second biggest surprise was, even though I'm ostensibly looking at what's wrong, I do leave this work over and over again with a sense of hope because I find these social entrepreneurs that are doing great work. They're very inspiring. I also see that there's a lot of what we might call green shoots with civil society being reformed in America. It's like our previous form has basically been in decay for decades, but I can find several dozen without too much effort newish organizations that have come up that are more participatory, more interactive, very place-based, very local, whether they're newspapers, whether they're some type of gathering, civil societies, all sorts of things. And I do believe young people want this. And so while I do see a lot of decay, I do see some hope emerging. And I think it's really a competition here. Well, can this grow? And again, you have to grow sideways. You're not going to grow up. You don't want these huge organizations. You want a lot more of these small organizations. Can we generate enough of this growth in lots of places while other things are in decay? Because for me, to some extent, we're at the end of an era. A lot of things that used to work and worked for a long time, they don't work anymore. You see it in civil society. You see it to some extent in the social service sector. You see it globally in terms of how the international system, a lot of things were good, but some things clearly weren't working. It's created a lot of anger and frustration. We see China in terms of its relationship with everybody else, how this has led to a rethink. And so the way I look at it, we're in an era where a lot of these things have to be rethought. And the question is, can we build new systems, new ways of working, new ways of addressing social problems? And my whole work on neighborhoods is meant to offer a new way forward, find things that work and to promote it and replicate it. I have hope, more hope than I might have thought because of what I see happening.
That's really exciting to hear.
Yes, we should be hopeful. I know we look around, we read the politics or the polarization. I would say get off the TV, get out on the street, get around the corner. Find neighbors, find local organizations, and find a way to roll up your sleeve and do something constructive because there's loads of opportunity if you look for it almost everywhere.
You are leading me right into the question that I was going to end our conversation with, which is, what can people do? What can our listeners do that they can take away and do something really practical right now?
Well, again, it depends your situation, but let's start with three directions that any individual can do. And if you want me to elaborate on a little bit bigger scale, we can do that. One is, you can simply go out your front door, look up and down your street and see, who can I meet right here? Mm-hmm. What can I do? Do I know my neighbors? Can I knock on the door? Can I put a bench out in front of in my neighborhood? We are very communal. And a lot of people know each other. There's loads of local institutions. When COVID hit, one of the most obvious changes was everybody put benches, chairs, everything in front of their house. Wow. And we just kept talking. We just started talking outside. And when the weather got cold, I can think of people like someone around the corner here. They put the couches in their carport. We don't really have garages, but we have like a covered driveway. And they put a heater outside. Mm. And you could still sit outside. Maybe you're wearing your coat and you have a heater. But the point was that we didn't want to lose our connection, and all this volunteerism sprung up. So the first thing I would do is ask, how can you know your neighbors more? Can you knock on a door? Can you do something? A second thing is, do you know at least a couple of people or one person that's near you within a couple of blocks that you can work together? I don't know if it's a block party. I don't know if it's some local gathering that you bring a few people, they bring a few people, and see where it goes. So the first thing is yourself. Mm-hmm. Second thing is find one or two people and do something that you can just do on your own. Ideally, your city encourages it. I'm thinking like a city like Boston, they literally have around Halloween, around, I think it's spring, the springtime, the summertime, and the fall. I think fall is Halloween. They have initiatives where they literally give people some money or give some people some special support and encourages everybody to get out there with their neighbors. So you could have that support. You could do it. The third thing is, look for hyper-local neighborhood institutions if possible, or it could be a neighborhood one over from you, and see if you can participate, see if you can join, see if you can volunteer, see if you can even go and ask, what can we do? I mean, it can even be a very local coffee shop. Sure. Have you thought of doing something like this? Can it be a nonprofit? Can it be a Y? You know, there's a lot of things going on. Not all of it's very local, but even a library. I gave a talk to the management of the Salt Lake City public library system. And so they exist around the city, but they're not really hyper-local. They're not really in the neighborhoods. But could libraries do stuff in neighborhoods? Can you use the school building after school on the weekends? I mean, think of the public institutions, think of the private. How could they step up? So the third thing is, I would say, is look for institutions that already exist. It could be a church. It could be a synagogue, a mosque. It could be the library. It could be a small business. Could be a civic institution. What can we do in partnership with institution, or what role can I play to activate these in a more local manner? So that would be the easiest thing. I could add a fourth if you want. If you want it to be more ambitious and you thought your neighborhood had to improve, again, it's probably some combination of two or three, and three, partner with a few people, partner with an institution, and take the initiative to do some process to change your neighborhood. It could be as simple as, I'm thinking my neighbors, they changed the light because they wanted to walk across some street to get to the little shopping district we have. Not pretty, but at least we have a shopping district. So they did that. I'm thinking of people that lobbied the government to build a bridge over a creek. I'm not sure I happen to like not walk. I like walking over the stones. But anyway, the fact is people have strollers. Not everybody can walk over it, but now there's going to be a bridge. I can think of neighbors that came. I have a neighbor down the street. I'm at 910. She's at 903. She organizes park cleanups. She goes and knocks on doors that people who live alone. So, you know, there's so many things we can do that make our places better. Let's treasure our places. Let's partner with people. We can't control national. We can't even have a big influence often on our state or our city, but we can have a really, really big influence where we are. We all need to step up and find a way to do that. And we will find agency and enjoyment in that process.
I love the confluence of place and relationship. that place is about relationship. The thing that we care about when we think about the places we love, it may be a pretty place, but when we combine that with wonderful relationships, those are the feelings that last our lifetimes. And I love that confluence of place and relationship. You've given us so much to think about, Seth, and I am so grateful. As you continue to think through things, I hope that you'll come back and share more with us.
I would be delighted to. You just have to ask. And hopefully I'll also be in Tucson sometime. As I told you, my mother's there. So what a wonderful place to live.
We think so. And we're building neighborhoods.
Great. I like to visit your neighborhood sometime.
I will happily tour you around. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
I'm so grateful to Seth for sharing his observations and experience with us. I'm struck by the confluence of people and place in Seth's work, and the importance of having institutions that the people can rely on in those spaces. And I really appreciate the breadth of what Seth defines as institutions. His example of the person who started by creating a small neighborhood farm and then turning that institution into a vehicle for relationship building, and how the farm became a coffee shop and a market and a variety of spaces for community members to come together. As Seth talked about the circles of influence we each have to meet our neighbors and to then band together with one or two neighbors to get something done, I can't help but reflect on my own neighborhood, where a group of everyday people got together to clear out an overgrown drainage area and turned it into a park. What was a no man's land is now the place where we all run into each other, walking dogs or jogging or just hanging out. Seth's emphasis on the confluence of place and people and institutions, it's a reminder that we all have the power to make life more livable and joyful right where we live. When we talk about change happening from the bottom up, that's where it all begins. Place, people, institutions. You can learn more about Seth's work at the podcast page for this episode. And of course, if this episode got you thinking, we hope you'll share this podcast with your friends and colleagues and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, you can learn more about Creating the Future's work at creatingthefuture.org. Thank you for being with us today and for wanting to create a better future for our world. We'll see you next time here at Creating the Future.